Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Scott Kennedy, a professor of political science and East Asian languages and culture at Indiana University and the director of the Research Center on Chinese Politics and Business. He has written extensively about U.S.-China relations, particularly their business and trade relationships. He's the author of The Business of Lobbying in China, and he edited China Crosstalk, The American Debate Over China Policy Since Normalization. He's currently at work on two projects that focus on China's participation in international economic regimes and in placing the Chinese political economy in comparative perspectives. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Kennedy.
Good to be here, Ian.
And at this summit that just finished in Palm Springs, the President Obama's National Security Advisor, Tom Donilon, made it clear that if the Chinese didn't do something about these cyber attacks, et cetera, targeted against U.S. corporations for their intellectual property, and I believe they even got into the U.S. Patent Office to get advanced information on future products, that he felt that Donilon says it's a difficult problem in the economic relationship and was going to be an inhibitor to the relationship reaching its full potential. He went on to say it's hard to have a comprehensive partnership at the same time that you have large-scale theft underway. Susan Shirk said that the U.S. business community is getting pretty fed up with China. Is that a fact?
It certainly is. Last week, I attended the annual meeting of the U.S.-China Business Council meeting in Washington, D.C., which is the council is one of the premier organizations representing the businesses that do business in China. And the primary subject for the day was cybersecurity. And it's something that American businesses are quite concerned about. It's in the way that the Taiwan issue is for Chinese as the stumbling block for the relationship with the U.S., cybersecurity could come to mean for the U.S. that same type of issue, that it's something that has to be addressed in order for there to be progress on just about anything else.
But it's pretty clear that this is a two-way street, right? The United States is not simply unilaterally disarmed in terms of cyber espionage.
Yes, correct. I think what we're seeing is a parallel to the early days of the Cold War in the development of arms, nuclear arms control, where there weren't clear norms of the road. The norms of deterrence and first strike or other types of capabilities weren't clear, and we gradually developed that with the Soviets. And we're in the same days now in which the rules for cyber espionage, for cyber war, for cyber crime aren't clear, and we need to develop those rules of the road. And both parties agreed yesterday and over the weekend to do so. It's a key topic of the strategic and economic dialogue, and we'll see this as a central topic at a variety of global fora as well.
So, in terms of what the both leaders have referred to as a constructive summit, what's the takeaway here, and how much is this agreement that they have on addressing global warming and curbing CO2 emissions, which of course China is, I think, has now surpassed the United States. That means that most of what's up there already is what the U.S. has put up over the last few decades, but what's going to be up there in the future is what the Chinese are putting up, right?
Absolutely. I wouldn't focus on any specific agreements that come out of this meeting as, you know, as deliverables as what's important for the meeting. I think what we should take away from the meeting is the meeting itself, and this was an informal gathering of the leaders of two very important countries, China's leader for the past 10 years, Hu Jintao, would have been extremely uncomfortable and non-engaging in this type of event. And so it represents a change for China's leadership, and China recognizes that its economic model that it's followed the last several decades isn't going to work. And at the same time, that it's had problems within China with regard to environmental pollution, with inequality, et cetera. It's also caused them a lot of problems globally with its trading partners, including the United States. And I think this was the way that Obama wanted to have a reset in the relationship with Russia when he came into office. This meeting is part of a resetting of the relationship between the two sides most broadly, including on economic issues.
Again, I'm speaking with Scott Kennedy, professor of political science and East Asian languages and culture at Indiana University and the director of the Research Center on Chinese Politics and Business. He's written extensively about U.S.-China relations, particularly their business and trade relationships, and he's the author of The Business of Lobbying in China, and he edited China Crosstalk, The American Debate Over China Policy Since Normalization. But in terms of what's happening to the Chinese economy, which has been driving global growth, and I guess you know it's dependent upon consumption, which is slowing down clearly in Europe. Maybe it's feebly coming back here in the United States. I believe consumption's also slowing down in China itself. But now China has signs of some real signs of their growth rate slowing.
I think there's obviously some serious cyclical issues that are occurring in the global economy in Europe, elsewhere, in Japan. But I think the focus of policy in China now is addressing the structural problems that affect their growth over the medium to long term. And the type of investment and export-led growth strategy that they've had the past few decades is going to be of declining benefit for them. And they realize that, and that they need to focus on developing a much more innovative economy in which consumption by Chinese consumers is much more important than consumption by American consumers or investment by Chinese companies. There's going to be plenty of those they're going to need, but those won't be the future drivers of Chinese growth. And so that's what they're doing, is in the middle of a cyclical slowdown, also addressing a structural problems. And so so they've been willing to sacrifice some short-term growth to help push the economy onto a new development path. So I don't think the Chinese leaders yet are too worried that their economy is growing too slowly. I think if it were to go under 7%, then the alarm bells in Beijing would go off. But I think they're, for the time being, they're concerned. And for us, we got to get used to this, that slower Chinese growth isn't going to necessarily mean a re-ratcheting up of investment and expansion of credit to state-owned enterprises.
Well, apparently, President Xi told Obama that the 7.7% growth in GDP was achieved in the first quarter, and that pace is beneficial to adjusting the economic structure and improving the quality of and returns of economic growth. He went on to say, while fully seeing the optimistic prospects for the Chinese economy, we believe that it also faces some risks and challenges. Overall, these risks can be generally held in check. We are taking focused steps to further avert and diffuse them. What are these risks that he's talking about?
Sure. Well, China has built up a great deal of debt in the wake of the global financial crisis. They had a $4 trillion Chinese dollar stimulus package, which was critical for them from sliding into recession, but it led to a buildup of debt and inequality. They also have, shrinking profit margins because where they dominate in manufacturing and assembly, the margins from that are shrinking, and they have to move out of that. China, obviously, for anyone who's ever been there or watched on TV, has huge environmental problems that they have to address, which also cuts into growth. And so these are all things that the Chinese government needs to tackle. And I think they recognize that these are huge problems, and they're beginning to develop a blueprint to address them in a way that they haven't in the past. We can't say for sure that policies coming out of the new government are going to be wholly different from what we've seen in the past, but they've given pretty strong signals the past few months since Xi took power as head of the party, and that they're going to be doing things that are different in promoting consumption, reducing restrictions for Chinese to move about and work in different parts of the country, to make reforms in education, and the financial markets, which should help lead to more efficient growth, cleaner growth, things that we as Americans will also benefit from as well.
Well, it seems that while the new Chinese leader is cracking down on dissent at home, the brother-in-law of the Nobel Peace Prize laureate was just arrested. He also appears to be going after vested interests in the economy and wants to break up the monopolies and oligopolies of these state-owned enterprises, which I take it have lobbies of their own, right? Or certainly inertia of their own.
Well, certainly the Communist Party has focused on making the Chinese economy much more competitive and productive the last few decades. The previous leadership that was in power from 2002 to 2012 made it their primary focus to support state-owned enterprises and give them much easier access to credit and a whole host of other benefits. That obviously helped make China the manufacturing powerhouse it is today to some extent, but it also built up a bunch of problems. And these folks who were enriched also, yeah, they become the stakeholders and interest groups that you have to tackle. I don't think that the new leadership, Xi Jinping, are going after state-owned enterprises as their first priority. I think what they're going to do is try and shape the overall environment of the economy to make it generally more competitive and to free up interest rates for loans, to open the capital accounts, to free up prices for energy and other utilities. And those things ought to require state-owned enterprises, like everyone else, to be more efficient and productive. And then I think you'll see expansion of access into state-dominated sectors by private and foreign companies following on that.
But how does he do with the sort of deal with President Xi, the structural corruption there? Because, you know, you have obviously, as state-owned enterprises transfer or morph into private enterprises, there's tremendous potential for even more corruption than there already is. Look at Russia. That went through that same evolution, where vast state enterprises were basically taken over for pennies on the dollar, and overnight billionaires were created. Now, there's clearly a lot of corruption there, and it's deeply entrenched and
goes China
right to the top.
By any measure, China has a great deal of corruption. I think. You know, and given how China has done over the last 30-some years in terms of its economic growth, China is one of the strange examples of a country that proves you can grow as fast as anyone while having extensive amounts of corruption, theft of IPR, amazing amounts of pollution, and you know, poor protection of other property rights. But that formula isn't going to work. Their strategy for dealing with corruption now isn't necessarily much different from previous administrations. They've put someone who's very authoritative, Wang Qishan, head of that job, and they are trying to force state-owned enterprises, the military, and others to limit their amount of spending on gifts and banquets and other types of things.
Right. Instead of 12 courses, they're now mandating, what, five courses at banquets?
Exactly. So, and, you know, it's hurt the flower business and the gift giving business, watch business. But they're not doing really what most of us outside analysts believe that they really need to do to deal with corruption, which is to have greater external sources of accountability, including a more independent judiciary, a freer press. Those type of outside eyes and ears, which can hold officials accountable. Now, you've seen some of that through social media and some of the press, but it's not systematic. And really, it's still in the party's hands to crack down on corruption. And it's really and it's hard to have, you know, when you're the ones that are corrupt, to be responsible for yourself. While we may see some short-term and maybe medium-term improvements in the question of corruption, until they allow more systematic external accountability mechanisms, I don't see them really making fundamental progress on this.
Well, just in closing, Scott Kennedy, clearly because of the breaking stories over the NSA snooping on American citizens, the revelation of the PRISM project, and the extent to which there was an embarrassment to the president with the release of a finding, presidential finding, targeting other countries for cyber attacks on the very eve that he's lecturing the Chinese about it. But there's another way to look at it. Susan Shirk was suggesting that I think it probably tells the Chinese. She feels it tells the Chinese how much more sophisticated the United States is in terms of its cyber ability. So clearly, both sides are involved in this stuff. Do you think there's going to be you were saying earlier it's like the Cold War that took a while for them to come up with an arms control regime. Do you think that there will be a truce or something? I mean, what do you do? I have to tell you, Scott, my website, ianmouth.com, is under persistent, sophisticated cyber attack at the moment. And it's an absolute nightmare trying to keep it going. So, I'm very, obviously, a very unhappy person about cyber attacks.
Sure. Well, I always congratulate you. It at least shows that you're getting some respect, deservedly so. I think that, you know, I don't think what people are suggesting is that, you know, cyber espionage and crime is going to be eliminated. I think what people are suggesting, and all of you and me and all of us outsiders, we're all sort of walking around in the dark in terms of knowing, beyond thinking, you know, that the worst is going on. We really don't know. But in general, one would expect that there's going to, besides the level of sophistication, which I don't know if it's really that much different between the two sides. I would say probably the biggest difference is that there's a great blurring of the lines in China between cyber industrial espionage and cyber crime and national security cyber-oriented warfare. And I think in the U.S., those things are probably much more distinctly separated. And part of the ideas of developing rules of the road may be to some extent reduce the levels of this activity, but also get the two states focused on dealing with real criminal behavior in a constructive way, and then developing rules of the road for on other issues so that this doesn't become a headache. Obviously, we're going to spy on each other, whether it's electronically or not, but we ought to, you know, and that's been going on for eons, but we ought to make it so it's not something that is entirely problematic for the two societies at large.
But what about the idea that there's, you know, if American corporations can't keep their own secrets, the same applies to the government. And if the Chinese are able to get into the patent office and look at future designs, one way to address that problem isn't that on us to some extent? Aren't our protectors of our secrets incompetent?
I think there's a capacity issue, technical and, you know, organizational, for us to manage, that we'll need to deal with. I'm sure the Chinese as well, and it could have some extent an effect on how much the U.S. invests in China or the type of products we develop. I have pretty good confidence in American ingenuity and entrepreneurs, and even for the amount of IPR that is stolen, usually the innovators have a first mover advantage. That's obviously shrinking for a lot of reasons, including cyber theft. I can't say that I'm super optimistic that we're going to make progress on this quickly, but I still am optimistic about the U.S. economy overall and the strengths that we have. And hopefully we can keep this relatively reined in and from, you know, further exploding and deteriorating.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Scott Kennedy.
We're happy to be here.
Do a follow-up, I'm sure. Again, I've been speaking with Scott Kennedy. He's a professor of political science and East Asian languages and cultures at the Indiana University and the director of the Research Center on Chinese Politics and Business. He has written extensively about U.S.-China relations, particularly their business and trade relationships, and he's the author of The Business of Lobbying in China, and he edited China Crosstalk, The American Debate Over China Policy Since Normalization. He's currently at work on two projects that focus on Chinese participation in international economic regimes and is placing the Chinese political economy in comparative perspective. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the deadly intersection between mental illness and the availability of assault weapons.